Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Welcome back to The Messy Truth, Conversations on Photography. Today I'm talking to the brilliant Annie Collinge. Annie moves between the world of art and fashion, creativity and commerce in a way that stays true to her ethos and intentions as a photographer. For her, photography is a tool for transformation, for imagining a kind of illusion in the everyday. Encountering her work is to truly happen upon something miraculous, often a playful fantasy that is joyful yet carries a dark undertone. At the centre of her approach is the idea, and she has a meticulous, almost obsessive dedication to bringing her vision to life. In this episode, we talk about her influences, her process, the importance of knowing yourself, and what it takes to make a fantasy seem real. You spent a lot of time in New York when you were younger as well, right?
Yeah, so my mother, she worked at the Guggenheim in the late 60s. She was the assistant to the, like, director, as wow. I remember correctly. So she had quite an interesting life. So she knew a lot of artists, and she dealt with, you know, them day to day. Like, she knew Miro a tiny bit, which is quite weird. And she would go to, like, Max's Kansas City and have, like, surf and turf and see Andy Warhol there, which feels quite weird. Yeah, she was quite involved in the art world before she met my dad. And then she still has a lot of her friends still are in New York. So we would go and visit them and, like, stay in their crusty lofts and stuff. And I remember at the time being a bit kind of shocked that people lived like that. But it feels like the States generally has had quite a big impact on my upbringing, I think. And I still do. It wasn't actually until I lived in New York that I really noticed how American my upbringing had been, even though I grew up in England. So, yeah.
And didn't your aunt set you up on a date with Bill Cunningham?
Oh, yes. So my aunt and uncle live in the East Village. And my uncle worked for a long time for the New York Times. He edited the style section. And they're kind of quite classic kind of East Village, you know, interesting types. When I was about 20, I was staying with my aunt and she was like, you got to meet this photographer. I've set him up. He's going to take you out to lunch. And I was like, oh, God, like, I don't want to. It's going to be some crusty old guy. Anyway, so we met at Veselka, which is like a Ukrainian diner. And anyway, it was Bill Cunningham. And he gave me, like, advice. I remember him talking a lot about hats, but at the time I had no sort of idea of the significance of it. I just was like trying to get through the, like, embarrassing situation of, like, being set up, you know, for career advice I didn't really want at the time. Because my aunt and uncle were quite friendly with him. They would look after him. They would give him, like, you know, they would bring him food and stuff. They look after people a lot. And I guess because I wasn't that aware of his, you know, his page in the New York Times. Obviously, this is way before the movie came out.
Yeah.
But I mean, I did you know, appreciate that later, definitely.
Do you remember any advice he gave you? Did anything stay with you?
I just remember him saying that he wasn't that interested in photography and it was all about the fashion.
Amazing.
Yeah, which I kind of, I mean, it's sort of true when you look at his pictures. He's like, actually, like, you know, the way he sort of tracked down tribes of people, like, it, you know, observing people like that. It's not necessarily about that. I remember him telling me he'd been punched in the face, like, for taking someone's picture. But he might even talk about, yeah. But I mean, he was so sweet. It seems so cruel that that would happen. But yeah, no, it's just quite funny. These things you don't appreciate at the time. But now I'm like, you know, and I think when I first moved to New York, I went to a party with my, it was about 8 years later. And my aunt and uncle took me to this party in his honor at Bergdorf Goodman. And I was like, and it was so weird because he came straight up to me and said, "Oh, hey, Annie." And I was like amazed that he still remembered me after all this time. But it was quite sweet.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
I remember being in New York and seeing him because you always saw him on his bike and that blue jacket that he always used to wear, just like cycling around looking so sweet. But every time you saw him, I felt like you saw a unicorn.
Yeah,
it was just like this magical, he's just like this magical guy, like completely on his own path and didn't really, you know, take any notice of what other people did.
I know, and it's so funny, that blue jacket that he always wears, because then everyone started wearing those blue jackets, whereas that's his uniform for years and years and years. And it's funny that it became like a, you know, a fashion item.
Style icon. Yeah. Yeah. And you've talked a little bit before about how you can trace a lot of your influences back to the books that you read when you were a kid. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what you were reading.
Yeah, well, my parents, they used to go to Brick Lane Market every Sunday. And so they would buy us, well, partly my mum being American, I had a lot of American books in my, you know, on my bookshelf. So like one of my favourites was Norman the Doorman, which was written by Don Freeman, who's, I think his most famous book is called Corduroy, but it's basically about a mouse that lives in the Met Museum. And secretly enters the Met Museum open art contest with he makes a sculpture out of a mouse trap. I think it's called trapeze or something. And it's got like he makes the wire of the mouse trap into like a mouse on a trapeze. And I think they always have this like sinister edge to it because like he's worried about getting caught by the guards and like being killed. So I think I've always been drawn to books that have a slightly kind of dark edge to them. Like I love Dr. De Soto, which is by William Steig, who he invented Shrek as well. But his first book was The Magic Pebble, which is about a donkey who finds a magic pebble and accidentally turns himself into a stone, and then he can't turn himself back. And most of the book is like his parents weeping about how he's never coming home again. And it's like, I don't know.
I just remember the
sort of menace of those books. I don't feel like, when I read like books that have written now, they don't seem to have that menacing quality to them so much. I don't know. And I also liked a book called Snuggle Pie and Cuddle Pot, which is really old. It was written in 1918 by May Gibbs. And it's about these gumnut babies, and it's all based on natural things. They're from the gumnut tree, and they get like, they're always scared of these like Banksia cones, which are, they're monsters based on Banksia cones from a Banksia tree. But again, they're like, it was always quite sinister and scary. So yeah, I think like in terms of how that's influenced my work, it's been very like the kind of idea of something being like childlike and kind of aesthetically pleasing, but also having a darkness to it, but it can be brightly colored and kind of cheerful looking on one level, but have like a darker subtext. And I think that's definitely I can sort of trace that back. And I've got a child now, and I read him a lot of the books that I had when I was a child. And it's funny because, yeah, because it sort of, it reignites like where I can sort of trace back to why I'm interested in certain things. Like, yeah, definitely.
That's awesome. And another big part of your kind of ideation process and your research is your kind of sourcing or collecting objects, kind of scouring car boot sales and eBay and charity shops and flea markets. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that and kind of how it informs your idea process.
I mean, I think it's verging on obsessive, which is quite annoying. but I've had to actually stop collecting stuff myself because I think I've definitely reached the limit of all the things I need to own. I mean, I still buy things for like props that I like hold on to. Like I've got an Edwardian puppet theater at the moment that I might do something with. I think like I've never found particular inspiration from going to other people's exhibitions. Like I enjoy going to see art, but I don't feel like it gives me ideas. Whereas I can find I bought like an ostrich egg with a clown's face on it, or like, you know, just weird things, a giant packet of chewing gum. It can spark more of an idea. And very often I'll hold on to things and then, you know, and then suddenly like I'll just suddenly have a spark of what I can do with it. I might have them for years, but I think it's just like, I like the idea that objects could maybe take on a, like photography can give them a kind of life, you know, like a kind of you can imagine them almost being real. And I think that's what interests me, the sort of how you can transform something to look more lifelike in a photograph.
Yeah, it's a little bit links to that idea of fantasy in your work as well. It's like there's a sense of fantasy, but it's really grounded in reality, often grounded actually by the locations, which are often kind of domestic in some way, domestic and I guess a bit familiar.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely very intentional, because like I really like to shoot in domestic scenarios. I find as soon as something's in a studio, it becomes sort of clinical. And like I kind of think, yeah, if it looks like it's in a house or something, you could imagine, yeah, exactly what you're saying, like it could be real, you know. And also that's why I don't light things either, because I sometimes find when you light things, things take on a kind of dramatic, like theatrical, like, I don't know. And it sort of, it shatters the illusion for me. I like things to look kind of mundane on some level. And like, I'm always trying to find like simple places that allude to domesticity, like, you know, have carpet or a bit of skirting board or like a plug socket, but that aren't necessarily filled with things, but just kind of, yeah, just kind of hint towards a house or, you know. So yeah, I don't know, even if I do shoot in a studio, very often I'm trying to make it look more domestic. But it's actually quite hard to find those scenarios. Like I've always had these fantasies of like, you know, getting in with an estate agent and just always having like loads of empty houses to shoot in, but they always seem very resistant.
That would be great.
Well, I've tried. Whenever I do shoots, I like phone round and they're like, yeah, 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 but it never seems to happen. Like it seems very difficult to find, like, because I like the idea that all the furniture's taken out, but you can still see that someone's lived there, you know, and it seems quite hard to come by. Someone should do that as a location.
Yeah, like the
old
idea.
Crusty houses, not like, that's the thing about location houses, they're always like done up
swanky.
Too much. Yeah, they're too swanky, they don't look real. And I think there's a gap in the market, definitely.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about casting actually, because every aspect of what you do is very particular, but the casting seems another sort of important element to that, right?
Yeah, definitely. Like, it's funny because I know it's like a thing now for shooting like real people, but I feel like that's all I've been interested in. Like in the past, I've shot, you know, agency models, traditional, and it's quite very easy to shoot an agency model because they look amazing in photographs. But I feel like I was always interested in making like art directed portraits of like unusual people, as opposed to, yeah, like trying to make a really beautiful romantic image. That's not like what I'm interested in. It sort of ties back to trying to make things look real, like almost believable. I did this project quite a few years ago called 5 Inches of Limbo, where I made all these portraits based on dolls, but then I cast real people in the street that I thought looked like them. And I shot actually loads of extra ones that didn't work because you didn't 100% believe that it could be a real scenario. I mean, I know obviously it's not real. Someone dressed in like red goggles with like a fur stole on isn't necessarily real, but on some element, I think it has to be believable. And that's what I'm always looking for. Like, you have to think that I want you to almost think that like I happened upon something. And it has to be on some level quite natural. So, yeah, I think that's what I'm always searching for when I'm making pictures.
Yeah, I think that's the magic in your work. And sort of talking back to the location aspect of it, those pictures which are grounded in those domestic spaces, you totally do feel like you just open the door and there's just something miraculous and unexpected there. They really hit that right note of like fantasy, but like really grounded in like a reality that reminds you of like your nana's house or something. Yeah, I just really love that tension. It's great. And it feels as well, I think I often feel like sometimes the industry gets a bit sort of sanitized and stifled, because I think it's easy to become quite trend led. And I think there's so much weight on aesthetics now, and that being that carrying more kudos than sometimes the concept or even the storytelling. And what I really love about your work is that you've always made ideas like front and center. And I wondered if you can talk a little bit about how you develop ideas, a little bit about your process and kind of why that's so important for you.
I mean, I think in some ways, like why I think my work is like people are responding to it more now than they have before is because, I mean, it's partly because of social media, because I think quite in single images. Like when I did my degree, I remember like my degree show, all the photos were kind of single images. They didn't have so much coherence as a project. And I think now, because how we view images, we view them singly. It's not like before, there was a lot of pressure to make these projects that kind of, you know, that all fitted together and told a story. And then you could have like one picture that was just like a horizon or like a drop of water on a leaf. And then you then you'd like turn the page to another. And like, I've never really thought like that. I'm always thinking of like how I can make one image like about a strong idea. So I think like how I come up with the process, I mean, it depends what I'm shooting, but like, yeah, very often it'll start with an object. And then, but again, like I do tend to work in single images, less project based. And because I find sometimes when I get like, I just worry about things being repetitive. And I think it's like, I don't like when fashion stories use like loads of versions of the same photo. It always feels to me like it waters down the idea. For me, it's always just brave to use one image from that, even if it's been loads of work for that one image. That's the most important thing to me.
Another element of that we've talked about before is that you are exceptionally particular because you are creating worlds. Like every aspect of what's in the frame, you have a very particular vision for, right? So in terms of how you, as we said before, like the casting, but also like the styling and the props and the space, you like to be very hands-on with that, almost like you're art directing your own work, essentially, when you're working on your own.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's where I've struggled to work with, I haven't struggled because I've worked with lots of different people, but I think I'm incredibly controlling. And I think I've found in the past, like working with set designers and stuff, I've found that they have maybe been a bit frustrated at the level of control that I want, because every like item that's in the photograph is integral to making the image, I need to be part of that process. And I think a lot of photographers work like that too, but some don't. Some it's like, oh, you know, you get a set designer and they, you know, build you a great set and la la la. But I just for me, that just turns me into like the monkey with the camera that I don't want to be. Like, I actually find taking the picture the least interesting part of the process. To me, that's just recording all the stuff you've done before, all the building of the story. So it's very strange for me just to come at the end and just snap the picture. That's why I've always found it quite difficult to know where I fit in, because I've always been like that. So, you know, being able to control every element is really integral to how successful the picture is to me. And I've sometimes found as well, like, you know, with stylists, you know, them turning up with a rail of clothes on the day and just trying to make like a stylish picture is not how I operate. Every individual item, including the clothes, is really integral to how, you know, the story is formed. So it seems weird that I wouldn't be part of that process.
Did it take you a while to get to that point, to kind of realize that about yourself? Or is it something that you kind of knew from the beginning after a few shoots that kind of frustrated you?
No, I mean, it's something I'm still discovering now. I think I've always wondered, because I think I've always fallen between categories. I think I've, you know, I've been around for quite a long time, but I started out doing like, you know, portraits for magazines and stuff. And I always found that process really hard, because it was like, essentially, they'd be like, oh, go and photograph this businessman in like a boring office, and you've got 10 minutes with him, and you have to like try and make an interesting picture with a grey pot plant in the corner. And like, you know, and it, like, that sort of pressure. I mean, it's sort of a good learning experience, but I very often thought, God, I just feel like I need more control, because it was so anxiety inducing for those situations. Like, I can do that, and that's partly because I've had a lot of practice of like having to think on my feet about what would make a good picture, and I know how to compose a picture. But I very often thought, like, it would be so much better if I had some kind of way of planning it a bit more. And when I started to actually take a bit more control and like bring things to shoots and stuff and say, I want to do this, people were like, you know, they were open to it. And I think I've always thought like, oh, they're probably going to think I'm like weird for doing that. Whereas I feel like that was a real turning point for me, that I started to try and blend the work that I've been doing on my own with the work that I've been doing commercially a bit more. But it did definitely take me quite a long time. Like, I feel like that only started happening when I was in New York, that I started just bringing props and like weird things I found and then suggesting it to people. Whereas before, I think I just wasn't confident to do that. That was a really good learning experience. And actually now, sometimes I think I would like to go back, like the next shoot, maybe, you know, in the next few shoots I do, I'd like to add more element of chaos into that, because I've been working with Rotting Doing Bizarre, making these very controlled shoots, and I think actually it would be good to do something that was a little bit more like hard to control and just seeing what the result was, instead of like planning everything down to a T.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Is everything immaculately planned before you even get on set?
Well, if you're talking about the shoots I've been working with Rotting Doing Bizarre at the moment, then like we've been building these people kind of models that are dressed as like objects, basically, then yes. That's sort of, I think, the success of them, is that they look like we just threw it together, but actually they're painfully rehearsed. To the point, I mean, like, so anal, like the sort of precision, you know. You know, we've put so much effort into that, and I think that's but that's the balance, is making something not look too overworked and look like it did just happen accidentally. But it's also, you know, we just did that shoot for SZ, and like there's a guy dressed as a watering can, and you know, we practiced lots of different drops coming out the watering can. They are really well thought out, yeah, like really well planned.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I think so many people, you know, they can see and understand the value and work that goes into something of exceptionally high production value. But when things are a little more sort of grounded in reality, and obviously your work has that really kind of accessible edge, it's not about glamour, it's not about excess, it's actually the opposite. I think people don't understand that level of detail that you're talking about, and how much work goes in to make those ideas or fantasies or whatever like perform and hit that exact right note that I was talking about before. Like, there is so much work and detail that goes into getting all those elements together.
Yeah, because, like, if, you know, even the fold of, like, a sleeve can make or break it, like, in terms of looking like an object. So it's impossible. Just, there's no way you could just show up on the day and just hope for the best. Like, and also, something might look fine when you're looking at it with the naked eye, but, like, as soon as you look at it through a camera, it doesn't read. And so all these things, yeah, really have to be rehearsed. How we operate is, like, high impact, like, low production. That's what we're going for.
But I bet that's so liberating, right?
Oh, definitely. Like, that's the thing. We really are, you know, we shoot things, like, when we've been shooting together, most of it's been shot in their flat in Rottingdean. Like, I'll, you know, just go and I'll sleep on the sofa the night before and we'll watch YouTube videos. And then in the morning, we'll get up and, like, just practice how we're going to do it. And then, like, that SZ shoot, like, the model came down for the day and we just shot it in their flat. Luke painted the wall. It is actually, in a way, all about the rehearsal beforehand. I mean, it's not always like that, but the ideas tend to be sketched out, and then the clothes and stuff are chosen precisely for those ideas. So it's not like there's not that much element of, like, oh, just chuck that on there. I mean, there's a bit of that, but it's not like these things might work. It just feels very rigid in the way that it's planned.
You used to do a lot of those documentary projects, right? Because you did that incredible mermaid one.
Yeah, I mean, that was like, because I feel like that was sort of the beginning of, like, me exploring things I was really actually interested in. And, like, the mermaid project came about because I just happened upon that place, and actually a lot of people have shot it since then. But it contrasted the things that I was interested in, like the idea of something being real and a bit fake. And, you know, the whole idea about the mermaid park is that, you know, like, they said, oh, you just can't shoot the mermaids, like, in the park without their tails on, because they didn't want to shatter the fantasy for the children. So, like, all, you know, the children that go to the mermaid park, you know, do believe these mermaids are real. And I think that's fascinating. Yeah, and I made another project about this woman called Linda Levin, who I met on the street in New York. But again, it was a real process for me to work out what I really wanted to do. Like, I feel like shooting her in her apartment was a real kind of epiphany. Like, I remember her being, like, on her bed on this, like, brightly coloured satin sheet in, like, a weird yoga pose, and shooting her in her, yeah. And I just suddenly was like, this is more what I'm interested in, kind of constructing things in reality, because they were her clothes and her bedding and everything, but it was just making a strange picture, and she was kind of into the process as well.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because collaboration of all kinds is really important to you. And obviously you've had a few kind of long-term collaborators over the years. And then just then, like, you know, what you're talking about when you're collaborating with subjects and how much sort of life that brings to the work. And I wanted to talk a little bit more actually about Rottingdean Bazaar, because you guys are kind of a perfect match. It feels like you're just a great meeting of minds. And I wondered, like, how you guys actually met and a little bit more about how you kind of work and build ideas together.
I followed Luke on Instagram, Luke Brooks. He just made these really strange, like, little videos and photos of, like, you know, a lettuce leaf on a bottom and stuff like that. And I just followed him for ages. And I think because of the algorithms was to do with, because he was taught by Julie Verhoeven, who's someone I've made pictures with for a long period of time. So I was like, you know, I just followed him. Then I sent him a message on Instagram, and I think he got back to me about a month later, and I'd even forgotten I'd sent it. But and then we met up in King's Cross, and he said, oh, you know, I'm about to start a project with my partner James, and we're gonna be called Rottingdean Bazaar. And, like, you know, and I think at that point, yeah, I don't know how long they'd been together, but and so I was like, oh, well, I'll just come to Rottingdean. Why don't we try making some pictures together? I'd never been to Rottingdean before, but it was a nice trip. and it was quite instant, actually, they, I just realized they had a real similar agenda to me. And it was very like, and we've since become good friends. Like, it's actually quite weird. I probably speak to them every day. That's quite weird, isn't it? But yeah, I think it was like they enjoy like making things funny and maybe a bit dark. And yeah, they have the same appreciation for objects being very particularly placed, you know. And that's the way they style things as well, which is exactly how I work. Like, they'll find the exact thing to fit an idea we're talking about. And also they have much more of a fashion knowledge than I do. You know, I know a bit about fashion, but I wouldn't claim to know, you know. They just have good, like, James used to work for Kanye West, and they both like done all kinds of things beforehand. Like, Luke made stuff for Lady Gaga.
So good.
Yeah, like, so they kind of, yeah, I feel like they've got a better fashion education than me. And but yeah, it's just been really great. It's been really, like, meeting them has been really good, because I think I was, you know, my child was about 3 when I met them. And I think I was sort of coming out of the kind of the motherhood kind of thing where you feel that it's kind of overtakes you for a couple of years. So it was quite, it felt like good timing, and it was a good time for them as well, because it was sort of like the beginning of them too. I mean, we both work with different people as well, but I think it's just been, yeah, it's just, and we, and like, even now it's like, it's a good, like, you know, like, we both discuss ideas that we're doing separately with each other, which is really nice as well, because I think I haven't really had that. I've often felt like a one-man band. So it's nice to discuss things in a really intense way, like how things are going to work, very specific details of things. That's been really useful for me, because I haven't, yeah, I haven't 100% felt like I've had that exactly. I've had it a bit, but I think they're also into it too. So that's been really good.
It's amazing. I think people don't talk about how important it is to have that alignment with of taste and sort of visual language with your collaborators. I think there's just, there has been for years, like, obviously such a focus on collaboration, and it is so important and can bring so much to your work. But getting it to the level that you're talking about, where you're just so in sync with each other, is actually really rare. It's quite a precious thing, I think.
Yeah, no, definitely. I just feel really like, I mean, it sounds cheesy, but I feel like it's really powerful for me, because I hadn't really been doing that much fashion. And it's only in the last few years that I've started working more in fashion. But it makes sense because of my work being quite object based. And I think where I'd struggled working, doing shoots involving fashion before, was I always felt there was this weird clash with like the stylist or whatever, where they were they needed to get this certain thing in, and they were like putting, and I just didn't feel like it worked, but then I felt awkward about saying it. Whereas like with them, it's very much like I'm just like, no, and they're like, no. But I mean, they're very involved in the entire process. Like, we edit the pictures together and everything. So it's not just me. It's not a traditional relationship at all in terms of like stylist, photographer, art director. It all feels quite mixed in. Yeah, and that's been really good for me, because I just feel like before I just wasn't really sure which way to go with it, because I was making like portraits, but then, yeah, I wasn't sure how to like call myself an art director or whatever, because that, it's like we were talking about before, it's like the whole idea of an art director is people don't 100% understand what that means either. So
yeah, it's odd, isn't it? I mean, definitely, you know, 10 years ago, it was much more about the photographer was there to do the technical stuff and light everything and sort of bring to life someone else's idea. It feels like there was less focus across the whole industry in like all photographers doing personal work and photographers being very involved in the ideas process. It was more like you just shoot whatever the, you know, agency art director tells you to do or the magazine photo director tells you to do. Whereas now, I think, you know, in some ways that sounds odd, because now it's so much more common for photographers to play a bit more of a hand in the art direction of everything that they're creating, no matter whether it's personal or commercial. But it's so important, because it really does take things to another level, I think, because you are bringing that whole vision. You're not just bringing like a technicality around the the camera, you're bringing so much more sort of idea and soul to whatever it is you're making.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, the you know, like, being technical is so boring to me. It's funny because, you know, I've probably owned only about 3 cameras in my entire life. I mean, for a photographer, that's quite pathetic. But I mean, it just doesn't interest me. And it's funny because people, like, sometimes you'll get on shoots, people will start asking me technical questions I don't even know the answer to. And I just think it's really boring. Like, I found at college, like, a lot of the class was quite divided into people that wanted to make interesting pictures and then people that just wanted to talk about lenses. And to me, it was like the least interesting thing ever. It's like when you go to a photography talk and people ask what camera the photographer's
used. Don't.
And it's like, oh God, it's so boring. And like, in the same way, like, I don't want to be a technician. It's not interesting to me. I don't want someone to come to me with like an idea for a magazine and just want me to execute. I mean, that does happen sometimes, but it's like, you know, I don't want to just be, yeah, the technician that comes along and just snaps away and tries to realize their idea. Like, I need to be at the beginning. That, for me, that's the most successful way of making pictures. So,
yeah,
it's funny. I think, yeah, and my technique is really quite basic on purpose, you know, and I don't like having a big production. I don't like having loads of lights and being really obvious. Like, when I just like it to be lo-fi on purpose because it stresses me out, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I don't think being stressed is particularly conducive to being creative. I mean, it can be, but like, yeah, like when you're actually shooting, like, I don't like loads of people standing around that I don't know what they're there for. You know, I just find that people give their opinion because they feel like they need to say something. When I'm working for Rottingdean Bazaar, we don't use hair and makeup. It's partly because it's just more people on set. And, you know, a lot of the time we're shooting, you know, real people, and it makes people feel more uncomfortable, I think. So, yeah, that's,
you need it, that intimacy.
Yeah, I think so, definitely. But I think maybe I got that from starting life as a portrait photographer, because I realized that, you know, it was really, that's the most vital thing, is making people feel comfortable, you know. It's not just about you coming along and, like, you know, they'll give you more if they're comfortable. And if they're not, they, you know, they won't. So, yeah.
You're listening to The Messy Truth, Conversations on Photography.
I think it's so great to hear you talk about your process and kind of how you have become attuned to how you make the best work, because all of your visual decisions also are tightly linked to your process decisions, and like, the work you're making and how you kind of make that work are intrinsically linked to who you are and kind of what your vibe is and what makes you feel comfortable and how you can get into that space of making your best work. And I think people, especially, I speak to a lot of people when I'm mentoring, who are just desperately trying to figure out, like, what is their process? What are they trying to say? What is their identity as a photographer? But I think they're always looking outward. They're looking for validation in terms of, you know, they see someone with a big set and a big lighting setup, and that, like, apparently legitimizes them, where actually it's so much more about looking inward and, like, figuring out how you make the best work that you can make by making all of these little tweaks to create, yeah, the best environment and best process to kind of realize the ideas that you have. I think people get so confused about that, and it really is something that you just need to tune into over time and kind of keep trusting yourself.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's taken me a long time to get to that point. Like, when I graduated, it felt like, oh, you had to, like, have a studio and, like, have a full-time assistant. You had to all look really professional. And I always found that so awkward. I just never enjoyed, like, I don't really like having assistants on shoots, because I always feel like I don't know what to say to them. And I feel like they're there and they're thinking, what kind of shot is that? That looks shit. I mean, you know, I mean, I have done before, and I try to avoid it if I can, because I just don't feel like it adds anything. I mean, it can be really helpful, but creatively I find it difficult. Like, I don't, you know, yeah, I feel like I have to come up with jobs to tell them to do all the time.
Distracting.
Yeah, I find it really distracting. And I think, like, yeah, I think it's taken me a while to sort of have the confidence to say, I don't want to do it like that. I want you to. And I think that's the thing. I think it's like putting out there to people how you want to work before you begin something is the most important thing. And I think, yeah, it's taken me a long time to feel confident enough to do that, like to be like, I don't want to work like that. I don't want to work in this big production way. It doesn't make it to me. It just feels like it costs more money and has less impact because things get watered down. It's like photography competitions, how the winners are always really boring because it's probably loads of judges in a room. They're not always really boring, but a lot of the time a photograph will win and you'll be like, that seems, but it's probably just because it kind of manages to get through the judges without being offensive.
Yeah.
On some level, you know?
Yeah.
No, I don't mean offensive because of like some shocking content. I mean, like, you know, stylistically or whatever.
Yeah. And I think, no, you're exactly right.
Yeah. To me, it's like, if there's too many people involved in the process, it just gets watered down. And, you know, that going back to like working with people that you're creatively in tune with, that's what's so nice when they 100% get what you're aiming for, you know? And yeah. I do feel that's really rare, like to be on the same page, like with minute details of things, like, you know, like, oh, that one hair on her head needs to curl round a bit more. Like, I'm talking about that minute detail. And for someone to 100% understand why that would be is really, yeah, is really important, I think.
Yeah, definitely. What has it been like kind of being a working mother?
I have found parenthood quite probably, definitely the most difficult thing I've ever done, which took me by surprise because I think I just assumed that I'd be like arrogantly an amazing parent, but you know, you just don't know how it's going to be at all, and you can't imagine it till it's happening to you. And it's like suddenly you've gone from being this selfish person just doing their own thing and like, you know, photographing people dressed as mermaids and stuff and like just going wherever you want whenever you want and like staying out all night and sleeping in till 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and suddenly you've got this like slug to look after that basically just, you know, takes every part of your energy, and it's a real fucking shock, you know?
And it really is.
No matter who like tells you it's going to be a shock, you just think, yeah, whatever. My child's just going to fit straight into my life and I'm just going to carry on before. And like when my son was born, I was living in New York. I lived in like a really crusty like loft building with three flatmates with one window, no washing machine, no AC in the New York summer. You know, we used to like go to sleep with like frozen bottles of water in our bed to try and stay cool. Like, you know, and I just, none of my friends in New York had children. I just was like, I wanted it, but you know, like the people I hung out with generally didn't. And suddenly I was like, oh shit. I did plan to have a child at some point, but it was just a bit of a shock. And yeah, and then basically, you know, this baby came along, and then there's like this weird period where you sort of are still in your old life, but you're pretending that you're not in this new life. And like, there's pictures of me and Al, like, you know, at these private views with like a baby strapped to us and like matchsticks holding open our eyes, like pretending we're still, you know, with a beer, and like, or I'd have people over for dinner, and then, you know, and then they'd stay till like 1 in the morning, and then we'd wash up, and then by the time we went upstairs, the baby would wake up and be awake all night. And or, you know, your friends come over and go, I'm so tired, and you're like, literally, you have no idea. And like, I think it was, you know, it was a real shock. Like, and you know, I just kind of thought it was going to be like a little side project, but actually it was suddenly a project that was completely overtaken. And the idea of like being away from, you know, I couldn't leave him at all. And like, I remember like when he was about 2 weeks old, I remember getting a job to go to Iceland, or like they asked me to go to Iceland for a week, and I was like actually considering it. Like, I remember like looking at flights and thinking, yeah, I can do this, and then I was just thinking, what am I, of course I can't, like, you know, It's like
you're fully delusional in that those early stages. You describe it perfectly, actually. It's like you're still in your old life because you haven't caught up with the fact that your new life is radically different to everything you could ever imagine.
No,
so
not at all.
It seems feasible to like contemplate doing a job, because of course you'd do a job, but then you're like, hang on a minute.
Yeah, I mean, like
a little bit upside down.
You know, I like you literally. Like my son would never, I mean, this is so boring to people that aren't parents, but my son would never take a bottle. So I could not leave him for like longer than about an hour, you know, until he was about three. No, until he stopped like breastfeeding. I literally couldn't leave him. So like,
yeah.
I remember, I mean, this is madness. I remember going to do a taxidermy course. God knows why I did that. That was the first time I went away from him for like 3 hours to go and do some taxidermy. And I remember getting back and he was just been like screaming for hours. And Al, my partner, was like, you know, like literally at his wit's end. And I'm like, you know, you just sort of do these mad things because you're just trying to like, you know, cling on to something. And I think particularly as a creative, you are really selfish. And I'm still really selfish. And I still struggle with parenthood for that reason, because you can't be selfish. You're raising a human. You have to be kind of, you know, yeah, totally available to them at all times. And like the other thing I found difficult is the kind of having to join society in a way that I never anticipated, because before you have a child, you're very like, you know, you choose who you hang out with and like you go to the places you want to go out, you know, you do what you want basically. And suddenly you're thrust into these like social situations with parents that you have very little in common with, you know, or like you're sitting around a table and everyone's talking about like side returns or something, or things that don't interest you, you know, because you're not that kind of person. But you sort of have to, yeah, you have to, yeah, you just have to join society in a way that you didn't before. And, you know, you're at baby singing groups, you know, and you're probably, you know, like I just would think, oh God, this is literal hell. But, you know, that's what you have to do. And, you know, this isn't to say that I don't enjoy elements of motherhood, but I have found it much harder than I anticipated it to be. I really did think like, yeah, I thought I would be like owning it. And, but I think in a lot of ways, it also makes you amazingly more efficient, because you realize you have these like windows of time and you really use those well. Whereas like when you look back on like all the time, I feel like I wasted so much time before, you know, I'd have days where I had no idea what I'd been doing. Whereas now I like, now I've got this many hours and I need to get this done and I need to do that. And I think that's really like, yeah, much more positive, you know. And also it's just, it's, you know, it kind of zooms you out of your life. It means that you're less kind of, you're not so centered around your every need. It kind of, it allows you to look at the world as a whole, I think. So I think it is really useful as well. But yeah, just a shock, definitely.
Yeah, I'm having a very similar experience. But I think you're exactly right in terms of that sort of expansion that it gives you as well. I think it gives you a real emotional expansion and kind of more of an empathetic expansion as well, which for me really helped me. I don't know, really, it really changed how I thought about ideas and how I thought about connecting and communicating through photography, because it just broke down some of the barriers that I had before and some of the expectations that I had before, and it enabled me to just, I don't know, just kind of think about things in a slightly more human way, maybe.
Yeah, I think it helps you be more, well, it's helped me be more empathic, because I that doesn't come naturally to me at all. That sounds really harsh, but
I think you're being a bit mean.
No, but I've really had to work on that, because I think on some level I'm not empathic at all. I'm quite, in the way that I think I'm a bit ruthless. Not like ruthless as in like shrewd business person, but I just think I do have trouble relating to how other people feel generally. And I think I've really had to try and, yeah, teach myself to think about that a lot more. And I think like my dad said, which was actually quite useful, he's like, parenthood is not a two-way street. It's like you're not giving so that you get back. You're giving, you know? And I think I was like, yeah, shit. It's not like, oh, he's going to give me so much back. It's like you have to really work at like making that person the best person they can be. You know, it's not about what you're going to get out of it. And I think that's a real shock as well to think like that. It's not like they're not there to service you, you know, yeah. be like your, you know, your accessory at all.
It's very true. You are someone who's been really committed to your own vision for a long time. And it feels like over the last few years, as you kind of mentioned before, everything has kind of really crystallized and come together. But I wondered, over the years, how have you managed to like block out the noise and kind of what your peers are doing and all that kind of messy stuff that, you know, can distract us? Because the pull of that can be really paralyzing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it has been at times. I think I felt, you know, inadequate in ways. But then how can you try and be something you're not? Like that's the conclusion I've come to, is that I think I tried out trying to be like other people, you know, being commercially successful earlier on in their career. And it just didn't fit with me because I don't think like that.
I'm curious as well, just, you know, talking about insecurities around work, because you are such an ideas-led photographer, do you ever have like a crisis of confidence with your ideas and doubt them or think something isn't strong enough, or are you pretty good now at kind of trusting your instincts?
Oh, I mean, all the time. I mean, I feel like that's just part of life, isn't it? Questioning.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of like being creative, isn't it? It's just basically feeling massively insecure about like something and then putting it out there into the world and seeing how people react to it, and then not being able to look at it for a few months and then looking back at it and thinking, oh, actually it wasn't as shit as I thought it was. No, because I feel like I've always been like that. Like when I'm in it, I find it incredibly hard to get any sort of distance, like, but then I can look back and think, yeah, that's all right. Whereas like at the time when I'm making it, yeah, it's full of insecurities. But I think because when you're creative, you're putting stuff out there and it's for people to judge you constantly. It's like in the early days when you do like portfolio reviews and go and see magazines, it's like constantly like bringing out your diary, reading it out to people sort of, and then what if they're like, oh, that's really boring. It is really personal, so it is quite exhausting, you know.
Yeah
of course.
I wanted to finish up by asking you the question that I ask everybody at the end of the episode, and that's, what matters more to you, the experience of making the work or the final photograph?
Definitely the final photograph, but I always like look at things, like if I get asked to do a job or I always have like a sort of checklist. I think, is it going to give me a good experience? Is it going to make me some money? Or is it going to be creatively fulfilling, or all of them, or some of those things? And if it doesn't tick any of those, then I say no. Ultimately, yeah, I do think the image is the most important thing. But what I was kind of trying to get at was that you can, you know, you can assess things on also having that experience, because photography allows you to have that.
Mm. I actually for sure thought you would say experience, because it's such an involved process for you that, as you just pointed out, kind of includes all these like funny experiences and spaces that you put yourself in to even like help generate ideas or
yeah. Sort of, yeah, I mean, I think we were talking about before like what your parents have, you know, and like I think I said before that my dad, you know, like I remember my dad took us on a tour of the Paris sewer when I was like, you know, probably about 7 or 8. And I still remember it. And it's still, I mean, it seems like a strange thing to take your children on a tour of a sewer with like, you know, like basically a big giant river of shit. But, you know, it's like, I think it sort of made me realize that there's lots of interesting things to investigate, and like, you should just be open to them. And that's why I think photography is like a really fun career, because it's not necessarily like you're gonna make thousands of pounds. I mean, you can do, but like you're not gonna be like mega well, well, you don't always end up mega wealthy. But, you know, you can have so many like weird things happen. Like I've been to prison, I've been to, I mean, you know, shot in a prison, been down a mine, been to a nunnery, you know, strange things that I never would have got to do without being a photographer. And it's like a ticket to lots of interesting experiences. But yeah, ultimately the image is the most important thing, I do think. So I sort of contradicted myself there, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm not 100% sure that you're sure of your answer. But
yeah,
I think
maybe that's the truth. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Annie. It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, you too, Jem. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to The Messy Truth. You can find more information about today's guests in the show notes. Theme music is Change by Judd Greenstein from the album Awake, and design is by Ruby White. You can follow updates on the podcast on my Instagram at Jem Fletcher or subscribe to my newsletter at jemfletcher.com. Feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.